Whose Rights, Which Rights? Global Contestations of Women's and Gender Rights.
Only 55% of all women worldwide are physically self-determined. Almost half of all women cannot decide whether to have sex, have children, or seek medical care. This was revealed by the UNFPA World Population Report 2021. And we're not even talking about LGBTIQ rights yet. And it looks like this will not develop positively in the near future. On the contrary, gender and reproductive rights will be questioned and restricted more and more. So in this episode, we will talk about gender and reproductive rights and how they are questioned today. For this, I welcome Andrea Petö, professor in the Department of Gender Studies and at Central European University, and Doctor of Science of the Hungarian Academy of Science. My name is Katharina Usling. I'm a moderator at Campus Radio Herz 87.9, and I'm really glad to host this podcast. Thanks for being here today. As in every episode, I would like to ask you to introduce yourself for our listeners.
I'm a historian by training, and I'm a member of this research group, the Global Contestations of Women's Rights and Gender Rights, here at the University of Bielefeld at TIF. And we have been discussing those issues you exactly mentioned in your lead. I'm interested in the dark history and bitter history of the European history. So I'm writing life stories of women who have been imprisoned and who were suffering. And I published just a book on the women in the Eurocross Party. The Eurocross Party is the Hungarian Nazi Party. This was published by Palgrave last year, that I was analyzing why these kind of unholy women joined the Eurocross Party, what was their motivation, where did they come from. And basically, I argued that there is an anti-modernist emancipation, which was a kind of a different form of the revolutionary modern in the interwar period, which attracted a lot of women. And recently, I published a book on Forgotten Massacre in Budapest on the 15th of October, 1944, where the perpetrator was a woman. And 18 or 19 or 20, we still don't know how many Jewish Hungarians were massacred in their own home in the center of Budapest, not far from the Octagon, if the listeners know the geography of Budapest, close to the infamous Museum of the House of Terror. So I basically, like a detective, wanted to figure out, you know, who did what, because we have got fantastic sources and the people's court testimonies. And I also interviewed the survivors, the survivors' families, and I also interviewed the perpetrator family. So that actually gave a very interesting insight how the different memories are interacting or not interacting. And the conclusion was basically that from 1945 onwards, there were two very different polarized memory culture was developing in Hungary, in other countries as well. But, you know, I just studied Hungary, and that contributed to this paradigm change in Holocaust remembrance, what we see nowadays as a result of the illiberal Hungarian government's action.
So you're working very close into the field and with the people who took part in such historic events. And because you already mentioned Budapest or Hungary, I would ask you about a topic which is not actually our topic today, but I don't want not to talk about it because it's so interesting. And when I Googled the situation in Budapest, of course, it popped up and I already read it in the news when it took part. And which is that Viktor Orban removed in 2018 the gender studies program from the list of approved programs. And the Department of Gender Studies and the CEU had to go to Vienna, I think, because of it. And can you explain in short why that happened and why the gender studies have been targeted? And maybe also what the current academic situation in Hungary and in Europe for you and for other people in your field is?
So the Central European University was offering two types of degrees. One was an American degree, which was accredited in the state of New York. And the other one was a program which was accredited in Hungary a two-year master's program which CEU offered in English from 2004, I think. And then the ETA, which is the main Hungarian university in Budapest, submitted a request for running the same program in Hungarian at ETA. And that was a trigger. And that was the trigger which started different attacks. And these attacks against gender studies professionals, and the concept what the opponents believe gender is or portray that this is gender, this was a very difficult period because this was the moment when gender studies became a pop science. Everybody had an opinion about what gender is, what the learning outcome of a two-year gender studies master's program should be, what should be or should not be on the reading list. So then suddenly we found ourselves in what Eric Fassin calls the kind of double exposure. So we were previously, I mean, gender studies was, you know, interesting, but we were a small profession, and even in our own institutions, we were, you know, considered as a small but important program. We had our offices in the attic, some colleagues had offices in the cellar, but we were doing a great work. But suddenly, this kind of public exposure changed our status. It changed our status because it turned out that gender and this whole issue of gender studies became a part of this global socializational fight over the what kind of alternatives are there after the obvious crisis of the neoliberal world order. And those who are using gender as symbolic glue, because they are gluing together different actors, different ideas, different concepts in order to create a concept which is gender, which has got nothing to do with any of the four definitions of gender, but it is a kind of concept in which they are using hate and exclusion to define what normal and how people should be living. And this kind of normative intervention into the way of life actually is a part of the present fight, which nowadays we can call a new Cold War over rights and exclusions and inclusions. And those actors, starting from politicians to public intellectuals to policymakers, they have a vision how the world should look like, what is livable, desirable future. And for them, this is a very simple picture, because then you have got men and women living in heterosexual families, and there are no questions. There are basically no critical questions asked. This is a pretty anti-intellectual approach, and using the so-called natural order as a final argument. So when this attack on gender studies started, those who were in the profession in gender studies, we knew that this will be coming, because we know that from Brazil to Russia to Turkey, and in some cases the IFA in Germany, they are actually attacking gender studies, because gender works as a symbolic glue. It glues the AfD, the Fidesz, the Hungarian ruling party, Putin's Russia, the Catholic Church in Poland together. And this is a very heterogeneous mix, which is only united by one element, namely that they want to create a different future. They have a very different vision of the future, and they have got a very different understanding how this future should look like. And here, gender and everything which is related to people's bodies and reproductive rights and intimate feelings are at stake.
So as I read, Viktor Orban's official argumentation was that there are not enough students in this program, so there's no need for that. But of course, as you already said, that's not true. That's not the real reason for that. And you already said as well that this is not a thing just in Hungary, but in all over Europe. And I would say that this anti-intellectual approach is not just in the gender studies, but maybe it started there, but it's spreading more and more around. Maybe because it's related to the COVID-19 pandemic as well, because here in Germany, we see a lot of that there is no trust in science anymore, and that just someone from the street says, yeah, I know it better. I read it somewhere and I'm the intellectual profi here. And of course, that's not true because the academic research is very important for every topic. But would you say that this anti-intellectual approach will spread into other subjects as well from this gender studies thing?
So gender studies matters, not only for gender studies professionals, but also for those who are concerned with academic freedom and freedom of science. Because those who are questioning gender studies, they are very often using kind of surveys and academic sounding arguments. What you exactly quoted, that there were no enough students for the gender studies MA program. Which is, of course, not true, because we had 250 students for 20 places. So it means that we have 20 times more applicants than students. So what are you talking about? But, you know, the point is the communication, to fill in the space with this information. And also when it comes to different policy decisions, then people are just, policymakers are just pulling out ad hoc surveys, like those kids who were brought up in same-sex families, they have got often nervous breakdowns. And then you have to have the energy to comment and say, look, the reference you are giving is coming from a predatory journal, which is not peer-reviewed. I mean, it means that it is without any academic or scientific grounding. Why are you using this? But by the time you are getting into the discussion with that person who actually published that article or survey or Facebook post, then it already had been spread. So the social media actually changed the whole dynamics of scientific communication and also the content of scientific communication. So it became very quick, extremely superficial, and without any quality control. So anybody can be an expert and publish anything about this. And this is the populist turn. So basically, this is the price what we are paying, that you know, you can connect any moment with anybody on Facebook, that the people, the populace, actually post its opinion. It's not wrong. What is wrong is that the politics actually uses this channel in order to manipulate and to pursue their own political agenda. And I think this is the moment where we have to stop for a second and think about, for example, a result of one survey. It turned out that in Hungary, all those posts which are against vaccination and who were questioning the usability of these kind of vaccines were coming from 5 people. And these 5 people, and I, of course, do not want to question their motivation or their background connections, they managed to infiltrate and put this doubt into the minds of tens of hundreds of thousands of people. So it means that there is a very different communication model and a very different politics, which is actually happening now. But I have to say, I disagree with you in a sense that science has been undermined. I think that the trust in politics had been undermined because the scientists had been, they are doing what they are always doing. They're doing research, they are publishing, and some of them are getting engaged in debates on Facebook or Twitter or whatever. But the politics, because they were constantly keeping their short-sighted political agenda or even sometimes very ugly political agenda in, ahead of the rational and normal decisions, they actually undermine the belief in politics itself. And that I find extremely problematic and extremely harmful, because the concept of political community and polity as such had been questioned. And the individuals are believing that they can only rely on themselves, because the politics and those politicians who actually they have elected, they are not acting as they should be acting. This will have far-reaching consequences, and we already see it in the different elections that the far-right parties, which are actually using this tide to, and this is interesting, to offer a strong state, to offer a strong, reliable state, they are using the anxiety and the fear of the individuals, which are very legitimate. I mean, if you look at the communication of the federal government in Germany, I mean, sometimes this is the statement, sometimes that's the message, yes. Sometimes there is a lockdown, sometimes it's not the lockdown. So, I mean, what the heck is happening here when we are sitting in the biggest health crisis in the 20th and the 21st century, right? So obviously the voters are looking for a clear, obvious message because they are totally exhausted. So therefore, the colleagues are actually thinking about this, if this global pandemic, together with the 2008 economic, financial, and migration crisis, could not have been conceptualized as the 1929 economic crisis, as a trigger moment for the wave of the rise of fascism or Nazism. So the stakes are really high, how the European states are actually handling this particular situation, because that can be, you know, like a trigger moment and electing those anti-democratic, anti-system parties in the coming elections.
I already talked a bit about this communication problem and how the politics communicate with Ina Kerner, but more about, of course, about her topic, which is religion. But I talked with her about the right-wing movements. In particular, you already mentioned the AfD here in Germany, and how they use religion as an argumentative basis to restrict rights for minorities and migrants and women as well, of course, and gender rights, of course, as well. Can you also state that in terms for gender and reproductive rights, not only for the AfD, but in Europe as well?
Yes, I think that's a very important statement. So Roman Kuhar actually argues that this whole anti-gender or anti-equality movement is nothing else than to re-clericalize the society, to re-clericalize in education, in thinking, in practices, in intimate life, to redo what the Enlightenment actually changed in the past 200, 300 years. So if you look at the argumentations of different liberal politicians from Estonia to Portugal, you see that they are very much using the same arguments of the natural order and Christianity. And of course, this will have far-reaching consequences in a kind of very diverse European framework, that how this religious argumentation is being applied. And then again, gender becomes a symbolic glue, because you see that the Jewish fundamentalists, the Islam fundamentalists, and the Christian fundamentalists do agree. They are glued together to achieve their purpose. So that's why what we see today in this new Cold War, and I'm totally aware of the implications using this terminology Cold War, and I just hate it, but that's actually what's happening. The cleavages are very different than the previous cleavages. So that's why I think we have to also unpack the concept of religion, because the feminist theologians, for example, they are also suffering as much as different gender studies scholars or individuals, because of this extremely harsh and brutal attacks, which also become their everyday reality. So in a sense, you are right. This religion is crucial, and we also see that the fronts and the cleavages are actually in a very different way than in previous discussions. And that's why I think that this research group here in the TIFF can do a fantastic work, because we are recognizing and trying to map the consequences of these new cleavages.
Because you already mentioned that the anti-gender or anti-equality movement, of course, is not a new thing. We know it from the history, of course. But if you look into the topic a bit, and if you look into the media, there is a narrative that gives you the impression that the anti-gender or anti-equality movement and right-wing groups are gaining strength again, and as if there is a thing like they were not there for such a time. But if we look at Hungary or Poland or Arkansas and the USA, for example, yeah, we see that there is a real effect on the politics, as you already mentioned, on rights for people. Would you say that there is a difference between something like a continuous anti-gender movement and an emerging one? Or is this impression deceptive?
I think this question is crucial as far as the continuities of the dark history is concerned. I disagree that this is the same like the century-long anti-feminism. I think what we are experiencing now is different than the traditional anti-feminism. So what is the traditional anti-feminism? That is saying that women's place is in the kitchen and women should be producing children and they should not work outside the home. But what we are experiencing now, and that's what a new element, is the faithful combination of the illiberal politics and a new form of patriarchy. And that is what Campbell called the neoliberal neo-patriarchy. So let me explain why is this important. Because after the 2008 triple crisis, the economic, financial, and security crisis, neoliberalism actually moved to a new phase. And this new phase, what Eric Fassin calls the neo-fascist phase of neoliberalism, is basically using all possible resources and controlling all possible resources to maintain its operation. Because after 2008, it was pretty obvious that the resources are scarce, right? And there is a precarization of the globe and everybody's life. I mean, to translate it to simple words, so your generation is the first generation after the post-war. So your generation is the first post-war generation which has got no perspective that you will be living better than your parents. Mm-hmm. Moreover, you should be happy if you are living at the same standard as your parents. So it means that there is this precarization of Europe. And therefore, the neoliberalism is becoming more ruthless, right? And using all possible resources. And let me go back to the other part of this term, the neo-patriarchy. So neoliberalism is basically using patriarchy in order to control the resources. And women's bodies, women's work, and women's reproductive rights are becoming resources for maintaining the neoliberal third order. And in that context, this doesn't mean that neoliberalism wants to revive the traditional Nazi concept that women should go to the church and to the kitchen, but this is a very different form of control. And I think this is a key element which needs to be emphasized, that the neoliberal neo-patriarchy actually uses women's bodies both as a reproductive tool and as a tool for the traditional production. And therefore, you see that these illiberal states are, on the one hand, speaking about traditional family values, dignity of women, that, you know, family is the best thing, what could happen with women. On the other hand, they are supporting with different welfare incentives that women should also take part in the labor market, possibly as part-time workers, because they have to take care of the bodies of the family members. So when we are speaking about work-life balance, which is a horribly misleading term, because this is life, means not that you are going out playing golf in Hawaii, but life in this term means that you are taking care of bodies of children and elderly fathers, elderly mothers, and your partners. So this is basically the unpaid care work, which is labeled as life, which I find slightly problematic. But when they are speaking about work-life balance, it means that they want women to do the unpaid work, plus do a precarious, underpaid work in the labor force. So this is an important transformation of the work, the concept of work itself. So work is becoming not a right, but actually a privilege because of the decreasing standard of living. Therefore, the employment, women's employment, which had been precarious already, will be even more precariatized. I don't know if this verb exists, but if it's not, it should. So how women are getting more and more exploited in the labor market. I just wanted to sum it up and underline that this is not anti-feminism, but this is a very complex structural configuration which actually controls women's bodies as resources.
Would you say that this development you described, work as a privilege and cutting down or using reproductive rights as a resource, can we see that in specific countries strongly? And if so, why?
So the reproductive rights are actually in the center of this fight. I'm sure that the listeners followed what happened in Poland, where abortion had been banned even for health reasons. It means that in the different hospitals, in the gynecological wards, they are actually set up a room which they call the crying rooms, where they put those women who have to give birth to their children, although they know that the children will die soon after the birth or will have fatal sicknesses which will strongly influence their life later on. If you think about this phenomenon, the room of cries, I'm sure that most of the listeners immediately think about The Handmaid's Tale.
Yeah.
And this Handmaid's Tale is actually, it's happening. So we are living in a dystopian world, not only because of the environmental catastrophe. You see that the possibility for bodies to reproduce has been decreasing because of the pollution is damaging the human body. And there is a data that for 2045, more than 50% of the births will be assisted births, because, you know, the bodies will be not able to reproduce without medical interference because of the way how we are handling our earth. But also, this is a form of control and the political control. So demography and the demographic discourse that there are very few children born became a discourse which is substituting the real analysis and the real change in the structural factors which are actually influencing the reproductive practices. This is an important agenda on the different illiberal forces, which are not only speaking about how the different bodies should be reproducing, but actually giving a normative statement that which bodies should reproduce. And they are the white bodies. So there is this built-in racist element, and also the bodies of the able and the bodies of the rich. Immediately, you know, the main characteristic of illiberalism comes into the picture, namely to differentiate between the desirable citizens, the good citizens, and the bad citizens, and to exclude those bad citizens from the concept of the nation. And again, if you remember in The Handmaid's Tale, you can see how they actually did that, that certain bodies, undesirable, non-productive bodies, were sent to a kind of camp or a gulag where, you know, they are picking up the nuclear waste and die very soon. So this is a dark legacy of Europe and also globally, to differentiate between humans, right? And to concentrate certain bodies under control to territories where they are not interfering into the lives of others. So these kind of exclusionary practices, which are going back to the colonial times, they are actually a part of the dark European heritage. And this will be the test. This will be the test of our Europe, that this will be a Europe of the values that everybody counts, or it will let this kind of differentiation go further, and this will have unforeseeable consequences.
So this room of cries is a very cruel but strong example for how close we are to this dystopian world from The Handmaid's Tale. And I also already talked about The Handmaid's Tale a bit with Ina Kerner. But would you say there is any realistic chance of reversing the current situation, or is the legal situation more likely to worsen in the future?
Katharina, this is the $1 million question.
Yeah.
if If I would say no, then I would not get out from my bed in the mornings. But yeah. I do get up, and lots of colleagues and friends and citizens do get up every morning, and they think, they hope, and they act. And I just would like to emphasize this, that there was a very good conference at Columbia University with the title, What Can You Do When You Think Nothing Can Be Done? This is a good message, that you should think about what can you do when nothing can be done. So I don't know what you can do, but I can tell you what I'm doing. What I'm doing is I'm very active on Facebook, Twitter, LinkedIn, Instagram, trying to share my work, my ideas, my concerns with those who are interested. I'm trying to write interesting books. I'm trying to get in contact with different interesting people. So we just launched a podcast series with three colleagues in the Johannesburg Holocaust and Genocide Center with the title Sleepwalking on the Assault to Democracy, that simply four historians of Holocaust and Genocide trying to think about, you know, what can be done and what do we learn from this? I'm sure that there are lots of activists, artists who are trying to stop this on their own way.
This was today's episode of Whose Rights, Which Rights? Global Contestations of Women and Gender Rights. I discussed with Professor Andrea Petto from Central European University about gender and reproductive rights and how they're questioned today. I'm Katharina Usling, and I say thank you for listening and goodbye until the next episode.